You're on the Plants Grow Here podcast. I'm Daniel Fuller. Come along with me as we enter a hidden world of deep horticultural, ecological, and landscape gardening knowledge with featured experts, industry professionals, and enthusiasts.
Lisette Mill was one of the first guests I ever pitched for the Plants Grow Here podcast back in 2020. I've consistently pitched her with topic ideas every few months since then, but nothing ever eventuated. Until now. She's a natural resource management, or NRM, professional working in rural Vic and the inventor of the Bandicoot Motel and the pop-up puddle. She also runs one of the best natural resource management Twitter accounts in the world, where she simply documents what she does on a daily basis and shares her insights. She finally said yes to talking about some of her innovations within Aussie natural resource management because she knows as well as I do that these ideas need to spread so that we can save as much of our native biodiversity that we possibly can, which face constant challenges every day as a direct result of human activity. Welcome to the show, Lisette.
Thanks.
So can you start this episode off by telling us about the type of work that you have performed in your career?
Ooh, how far back do you want to go?
Not your whole life story, but just maybe just give people an insight into, you know, where you started and some of the work that you've been doing recently.
Okay. If we're looking at the last decade, prior to starting in natural resource management, I had my own business. And when I moved to Australia with my family and young son, I had an opportunity to do something that I was really passionate about but had never actually done as a paid career, only as a volunteer. And so I went back and did some retraining as a young mum to learn the sort of jobs that I do now, which is working with landholders, helping them come up with biodiversity management plans, helping them determine what native vegetation would be appropriate for the needs of their property, like shelter belts, and teaching them how to do their own biodiversity surveys.
Right. And so what is a biodiversity survey and what does that entail?
The real low-key biodiversity survey, which people will be familiar with, is sitting with a pair of binoculars or walking through a patch of country and listening or looking for birds. That's one of the most simple biodiversity surveys that anyone can do, just walking around and looking at things. Some of the probably familiar with any farmers or people who are on the land biodiversity surveys is when you pick up a piece of sheet iron that's lying in the paddock and you do a biodiversity survey then. Sometimes not by choice. Some people do biodiversity surveys driving down the road and observing what they pass that's either killed by the roadside or trying to cross the road in front of them. There's lots of ways that you can do biodiversity surveys. The sorts that I tend to teach people how to do are the ones where you're using technology like remote sensing cameras.
I see. And you've shown us some of your footage on Twitter, which is great. So what are some of the things that you've learnt through using this technology and how have they helped landholders?
One of the key things that I've learnt from doing this kind of work with landholders is how many different species are out in the landscape that people working or living in that place never see. Never see because they're small, right. Cryptic, don't like people, don't want to be seen by people, are disturbed by human activity, so is shy, or nocturnal. And some of the greatest pieces of evidence that I've been able to help landholders see come under those categories. And one more is things that are, by their nature, transitory, ephemeral. migratory.
So I guess having biodiversity on a farm, like, why would a farmer or a landholder want to know that?
Many landholders are deeply invested in looking after what lives on the land that they farm. And that could be farming as a lifestyle block, that could be farming as a small business, so that could be a large property. It's all comers, really. But in the main, people who are on the land are invested in the things that are on the property with whatever business they're running. And sometimes they're less invested in the things that they discover that they share that farm with, that land with, particularly if they are deadly species, spiders, jumping jack ants. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's, you know, and we're being aware of the hazards that are on your property is an important part of managing risk. So from that point of view, also when we talk about risk, it can be where remote sensing cameras help landholders learn about the biodiversity risks that their property is being impacted by, like feral pigs, deer, foxes, feral cats, things that have immense potential to spread biodiversity hazards, disease, and cause harm to their, if they're running livestock, to their fences, and compromise the health of their land because they're pest animals. You can have pest birds, sparrows, starlings, can bring large amounts of disease onto lands, particularly around buildings. So there's that side of it. But there's also the other side of it, which is pure joy, absolute delight. That's an immensely important part of helping landholders find out what they've got on their land, is the joy of finding things that hasn't been seen before, that there are no official records for. And oftentimes that lack of data is simply because there are a lack of people doing surveys that give you proof of presence by way of a photograph that's irrefutable. And also because investment in doing biodiversity surveys on vast areas of Australia where the land use is agricultural has been low, because typically biodiversity surveys are done when development, large-scale development, is going to happen, not in the day-to-day, everyday, ordinary passing of time that can provide such terrific biodiversity data. And let's not forget, people are busy, and if you're running a farm business, you're often working quite long hours and you don't have a lot of time to stop and observe, and maybe the thing that you see fleetingly zipping past the front of your quad bike or the ute, or being, you know, moved as the dogs are shifting the stock, you might never get a clear picture of it because you simply don't get around in your workplace with a camera with a massive zoom lens on it. So the teaching people how to do biodiversity surveys is important for all those reasons. One final one, and this is something that's coming into play more and more. Farm businesses are increasingly being asked by markets, by consumers, and by the goals of agriculture in Australia to prove that they are good custodians of the unique biodiversity of Australia, wherever they are. And prove it so that that becomes a market advantage to the products that they may be trying to sell, particularly internationally, but also to domestic consumers, to be reassured that people who are working the land and agriculture are looking after things that oftentimes rely on agricultural land to survive. And having images videos, you know, like the stuff that I put up on Twitter. Having those things is absolute gold. And the more landholders that I can encourage to get onto this, the more people out there that will be able to prove that, in particular, agriculture is a very important component of the survival of a lot of our native species.
So, Lisette, you are a great follow on Twitter, and I'd urge anybody listening to follow. What's your tag again?
It's you can look up my name, Lisette Mill. I'm it. Or the Twitter handle is Agvocate. So it's the twist on advocate, but with a G, because I work in agricultural landscapes a lot. Agvocate_AU.
Lisette, one of the things I really like following you for is just one, seeing some of the success stories that you're sharing, and two, just the way your brain works. You've come up with some incredible innovations. Can you tell us about the Bandicoot Motel?
The way my brain works. It's like a goddamn octopus. Okay. I'm a very practical, solutions-driven person. And working in the field of natural resource management, it will be no surprise to anybody listening that oftentimes the kinds of money that's available to get stuff done and to help people is small. So much of the things that I invent to help people with biodiversity surveys and providing safe harbour from predators for biodiversity that might be on a property have been developed with the smell of an oily rag in mind. That's a, I don't know if that's a Kiwiism or not, because I'm originally from New Zealand, but certainly many people will understand what I say when it's talking about you do things on the smell of an oily rag. You try and create solutions to problems that have instant appeal because they are cheap, easy, and work. So Bandicoot Motels dropped out of my mind in 2019. Sitting at the dining table, I can remember it very well, drawing up a sketch, thrashing around in my mind about the issue that is facing a landholder that I've worked with for a long time, nearly a decade now, where they have on their farm a population of an endangered species, the southern brown bandicoot. And in many parts of Australia, southern brown bandicoots, or their versions of, are fairly common. But in the farming landscape of Moynshire in southwest Victoria, they are not. They used to be, but they're not anymore because habitat loss and the impacts of predators, foxes, feral cats in particular. And as a result of tangling with the issue of not having enough ongoing guaranteed budget to keep those predators at bay at the rate that would be required to prevent a localized extinction of the southern brown bandicoots, I started thinking about what could I do, what could we build that would help southern brown bandicoots avoid those threats even when no control of predators was being done, because there's large chunks of both agricultural and reserve land in my area where no predator control is being done simply for economic reasons. So the Bandicoot Motel started as a sketch, and that went from there to what materials could be used that are long-lived, strong, portable, and don't catch on fire or rot or get affected by termites. And so the Bandicoot Motel trial began, and we got a bit of funding to build a few from our federal electorate Wannan grants, applied, and the bases of the Bandicoot Motels were made by local
high school students in the hands-on learning program out of Warrnambool. They were put into site in the summer of 2019-2020, and they're still there today. One of these motels that went onto the edge of a fire break in a Parks Victoria reserve next to the farm was occupied by what we believe to be a bandicoot within weeks of it being placed, and has continued to be occupied ever since. The others, some of them have been by multiple animals, bush rats, swamp rats, they're both native, also suffer the same kind of predation pressures that southern brown bandicoots do. We've observed antechinus. We've observed young echidnas, even fully grown adult echidnas attempting to get into them, possibly because they provide a cool microclimate to help them reduce their heat stress from which echidnas suffer. And birds hopping in and out in the doorways, catching insects that also use them. There's been a whole manner of different uses of the motel itself, but also what we've been observing is multiple engagements with other species. So, for example, eastern grey kangaroos, redneck wallabies, and swamp wallabies all very much like to sit on top of a bandicoot motel, which is about 10 centimetres tall off the ground. They love to sit on them and groom themselves. Why? We don't know. I don't know. But it makes for a very entertaining viewing, watching the swamp wallaby picking off the leeches off its body sitting on top of the bandicoot motel. I've talked about echidnas. Koalas like to sit on them and survey the landscape. Often regular, the same animal will divert their normal route in order to go and sit on top of the bandicoot motel. Maybe it feels nice under their rear end. I don't know. Either way, they're all in it and looking. I need to talk about the pest species here as well. So those first original 9 bandicoot motels that went into the reserve and onto the farm next door, where both have southern brown bandicoots, not one of them in the whole time that they've been deployed has been accessed, dug out by a fox. Not once have we observed any feral cats targeting them, camping at the doorway or anything like that. And black rats, which are a pest species and are prevalent in both locations, what they tend to do is run across the top. They don't go inside. And that's nearly 2.5 years of remote camera footage backing up the claims that I'm making today. The bandicoots in the reserve and on the farm are probably in the area they're in quite low numbers. We're hoping that the rainfall that we've had through the La Nina effect will kick off their breeding cycle again, and that the animals in the reserve that have been using the farm will find the bandicoot motels, and it will help them increase their breeding success because they don't tend to dig a burrow. They use timber or sedges, garnier, to hide under, to have their babies, and then they carry them around with them for a time, which makes them very vulnerable to predation from cats and foxes. But it also means that the young bandicoots too, once they are kicked out of home, they are extremely vulnerable to those same things. So I'm hoping that these bandicoot motels will help a tiny population of southern brown bandicoots in southwest Victoria not go extinct.
Mm-hmm. So we will have a link in the show notes for a resource for people to basically copy your idea. Do you have a link that I could share with the listeners?
I'm working on probably going to be a YouTube video about Bandicoot motels, and I'm looking at publishing an online resource to teach people how to build them.
Fantastic. So if that's not ready in time, we will tell listeners to follow you on Twitter.
Yeah, it will absolutely go up there. But hashtag Bandicoot Motels. There's already some videos and footage and photos of Bandicoot Motels, and I presented late last year in New Zealand at the Australasian Wildlife Management Society conference about these.
So can we please talk now about the pop-up puddles?
don't I give them crazy names? Like, just,
yeah,
you know, when you're trying to think of what to call these things, you want to make them sound like they're cute and fun and different. Pop-up puddles were, you know, 2018-19 must have been a really good year for my brain. I must have been getting down on the stake quite a bit then because it was like ideas coming thick and fast. And pop-up puddles, again, a solution to a problem. How to survey for the full range of vertebrates and sometimes insects, though that wasn't part of the original scope. How do we survey for those things in places that are typically hard to know what's living in a location, or in places where it's not appropriate to put out a food-based or attractant-based bait to bring things to a camera? And again, working on the smell of the oily rag concept, the pop-up puddle was devised so that people can use the power of water and not be reliant on having access to water nearby in order to rig up a simple device that helps you record what biodiversity you've got. And again, my test volunteer farm was the first recipient of a pop-up puddle. It's a sheep property in southwest Victoria, and they've got a small fenced-off remnant that's remains of an old piece of bush that used to connect to the reserve next to it. And we rigged up a pop-up puddle there, and it's been there ever since. Filming what comes to this measured dose of water. And from that, some of the extraordinary things that we've seen over time. The farm did not know that they had gliders living in this remnant until the pop-up puddle came to town. And I can still remember the first time I shared with the farmers the footage of these gliders coming down the tree that the pop-up puddle is against.
Wow.
And watching the expression of the farmer who's been farming there for over 50 years when he saw for the first time ever this creature that his farm has been custodian of for so long.
That's so cool.
It's those kind of things that keep me in this. And yeah. I know from using the same tools in other locations where water is a precious commodity throughout the summer, that you can survey for species, particularly birds, but also reptiles that you never see. And from being able to see them and get their photograph or film on a camera, that goes back to what I was saying earlier about building up the proof of what people have on their property, what they're custodians of, good and bad, and make management decisions based on proof.
Wow. So I think something that a lot of farmers and landholders are concerned with, and Rowan Reed brought this up recently, is that sometimes they don't necessarily want proof of an endangered species on their land because that can limit what they are allowed to do, you know, legislatively. Is that an issue, or do you find that maybe it can help give landholders access to funding, or what are the nuances within that space there?
Quite a lot. Quite a lot of nuances, and suffice to say, when a pop-up puddle is built by a landholder, any landholder, whether they're a farmer or not, what it records is your property. It's your data. It's your information. If you choose to share that with anyone else, it's entirely up to you. We're finding unusual, rare, endangered, threatened species that have legislative protection can make people concerned that that will prevent them doing particular things, especially if they are in the business of agriculture. I like to remind people that often the real story is that what the landholder has been doing has supported that thing that they have recorded.
Mm.
And that is a more powerful story than the story of, I'm scared that I'll be told I'm not allowed to do things. There is a nuance in it because a lot of development, like in Moynshire, large number of wind farms being built at this very moment. There are a lot of surveys done on agricultural land to get approval and permits to build large renewable projects, increase the size of roads, build new railway lines, you name it. Every new development, changing of land use for a development requires biodiversity surveys, and often that is the time that these rare and precious things are found, because surveys in a lot of the landscape are simply not done. And if that was the trigger to prevent development happening, then no development would be happening in Australia, and that's simply not the case. So I like to turn it to a positive and say your data is your data. If you see or identify something that is rare and precious, you have that opportunity to leverage with it to access funding to help you do more to help protect it. But it's always your choice.
Yeah, well said. So the power is in the data holder's hand.
Yes.
Great. So can you tell us any tips for communicating with government entities and sourcing funding for natural resource management?
Well, across Australia, there is multiple organisations that are out there, Landcare, catchment management authorities, there's philanthropics, there's a whole raft of different entities that are out there trying to increase native biodiversity across the landscape, including on agricultural land. And as far as tips go, I think the best one is to start a conversation with whoever is in your local area that you like the cut of their jib, do a bit of looking around, ask people who may have worked with them before, and find out whether they're going to suit what you're looking for. It's always good to start that conversation and have in your mind what it is that you're hoping to achieve first.
Right. So it sounds like there are no shortcuts. There's no one website that you can go to find funding opportunities for my farm in this area. I guess it's just make connections, do Google searches, figure it out for yourself kind of thing.
Yeah. People who engage with their local Landcare network group often find that the people who are in those organisations have their finger a bit closer to the pulse of what's likely to attract funding, but not everything does. And sometimes supporting biodiversity and doing biodiversity surveys on your land is simply something that builds up that picture of what your biodiversity, what your land supports. And if future directions of the federal government go the way they're looking like they might, in time, it's probably going to be that evidence can be used to generate some income from the property. Now, I'm not across all the detail of that as yet because it's very new, but I encourage people to go and investigate looking at biodiversity support and ecosystem services with their peak body for farming, ask the question, or just do some Google searching on the Department of Agriculture website, federal, and find out what's up.
Great tips. So what do most people get wrong with regards to land care and natural resource management?
Wrong?
Yeah, what do they do wrong? I mean, there's a long list, isn't it?
Oh, goodness. Perhaps it's the expectation that there are endless amounts of money around to support landholders to do things that are biodiversity related or farm tree related. There are streams of tax incentives available to primary producers in Australia to undertake land care works. And if you go to the ATO website and search under the name land care, you should be able to find some fact sheets that I helped develop to support your knowledge on that information. In terms of wrong, I think the biggest thing, if we're talking broadly across everything, is a failure to connect. Perhaps that's based on suspicion or not knowing what that conversation might turn out like if you ring up a complete stranger and ask them about how do I build a pop-up puddle, you might get the response of what? Because land care in particular across Australia is community organisations based on their community's needs. And that may not be what your needs are. They may not match.
I see.
So, yeah, failure to launch, I suppose. Failure to build a relationship or invest in building a relationship with the local natural resource management entity, whether that's government or a community group, is probably one of the biggest mistakes that any landholder can make and not investing in it.
Wow. So I guess the flip side of that is that there's an opportunity to share knowledge that you've learned with other land care organizations and communities. So for example, like if you live in Queensland or something like that, and you're loving the idea of these pop-up puddles, well, why not bring that to your group and share that around so that the knowledge doesn't just stay in one area? Because the more of us that are using this technology, the better biodiversity results are across the country.
That would be what I would love to see. Absolutely. Because these things that I've invented, I'm not making any money out of them. I developed them and I've shared them and they are in the public domain. It's not a business of mine on those and how to make them. I want to see more people get more tools in their hands to better manage the biodiversity they've got and look after it and do things that actually help that biodiversity remain in the landscape. I want to help people connect with resources that enable them to do surveys, whether it's in their garden, whether it's at their school, whether it's down the mine shaft, you know, wherever it is, so that the citizen science information of Australia becomes denser with a bigger swathe of people adding in data. So that data isn't just about keen botanists, keen naturalists, people who go bushwalking, who do this for a hobby. It's also backed up by the connected landscape, which are often agricultural, and the data of people on the land, farming.
So I have three more questions for you.
First one is...
So, Lisette, we met through Twitter. That's where we first sort of connected with each other. How is social media a tool for good with regards to natural resource management?
For me, using Twitter has been an absolute revelation. I often talk about and demonstrate difficult and sometimes contentious topics like feral cats and their impacts, foxes, because that's something that I'm doing day to day. And what I've learned is there is a big chunk of the community that wants to learn about things that they are not deeply involved in. They want to hear from people who are involved in that stuff. They want to connect with people who've got trusted information, solutions, sensible ways of discussing things, who are respectful and who are willing to front the information. So for me, being an engager, an educator, a person who does a lot of stuff in the field, it's enabled me to take where I am doing work out into the public domain in a way that I don't think I have could have done through any other medium. And by nature of being a microblogging platform, Twitter stops the verboseness that's inclined to come in when you're passionate about something and makes you be very pithy about what you're trying to say, and short videos, so you really connect with people. And it seems to be working for me because, yeah, the feedback I get and the comments and all, it's really great.
I think that the reason why you do so well on Twitter is because there aren't that many people who are providing the level of content that you're providing to us. Like, I love it, and I know a lot of people love it.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. So what advice do you have for anyone who's interested in a land care or natural resource management career?
As a career, it can be extremely specialised. So you might have a particular interest in a particular topic on natural resource management, or a subject, like you might be interested in turtles. Education is key. Being invested and passionate about what you're interested in, but also being realistic that the natural resource management industry is small in Australia, that job opportunities tend to be on the open market out there for people who have experience in site rehabilitation, revegetation, doing biodiversity surveys for developments, and being able to talk and listen with a wide variety of the community, I also think is a key attribute of succeeding in natural resource management roles. But also one last thing is being authentic. It's certainly very easy to get typecast as, you know, you're that freaky greeny or you're that whatever. You know, people like to put people in boxes because it makes them easier to understand sometimes. And by nature of the multiple aspects of landscape management, biodiversity management, you are a complex. You are going to have a complex role, whatever you're doing. And so being able to communicate well and being able to build up long-term partnerships with other people is really, really vital. And for that, it doesn't matter what industry you've come from to a career in natural resource management. That's a universal skill that supports any role where you're dealing with people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's so easy to get pigeonholed as a greenie or something like that. But then I think the interest of somebody who thinks in a nuanced way is that, you know, people might pigeonhole you at first and then they keep listening to the things you say and then you challenge them and it makes them actually more interested. And it makes, when you challenge people just enough, not too much, but if you challenge them just enough, they actually become more interested in what you're saying and they sort of tune in a little bit more and they hit that bell icon so they get notified of your posts.
Yeah, I certainly find when I'm out and about and talking with landholders and community groups and students that being many things, having many perspectives, and being interested in new perspectives that you don't already have, it's really critical to building trust and partnerships long term. And being curious, always being curious, being willing to learn and being willing to be wrong, and being interested in what other people do and how they do it and understanding decisions that they make, right or wrong. I sound like a marriage counselor.
Marriage counselor.
My God.
It's good. No, but they are life skills. They're not just skills for your career, are they?
Indeed. And I think anybody who enters a natural resource career, whether that's being a volunteer or paid, that having that understanding of broader issues that are in play and realizing that your worldview is not the only worldview and people are different everywhere you go really helps you cut through biases and suspicion.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Lisette, we've come to the end of the episode.
Oh, thank Christ. Sorry.
No,
it's really weird.
It's going to be one of my favourite episodes.
It's really, really, really confronting when you've got to kind of
really
sound like, yeah, I know half of the stuff you're talking about.
Oh, goodness. Good as well, me. I thought you were really confident.
I'm a genuine and honest person, and you know, sometimes I say stuff to people that I think afterwards, my goodness, they must think I'm a complete twit saying that, or they will not understand what I mean at all because I've just thrown in some bonkers Kiwiism that my mother and father taught me when I was a kid. Yeah. So it is confronting, decently. But you know, that's a good thing. It's about as confronting as me walking into a project site and seeing the copperhead snake that I've been having near misses with for the last 6 years and it just looks at me and goes, yeah. Hi there. And I go, g'day, mate. Thanks. See ya.
We're not.
So, Lisette, I always like to ask guests one final question. It doesn't have to be on topic at all. Is there anything else you want the listeners to know about?
My latest invention.
Great.
In trial. It's called a Dunart Den, and it's a mini version of a Bandicoot motel with a few tweaks to it, and it is designed to be put into places where you don't have lots of bush cover, you know, not the sort of country that bush rats, swamp rats, and southern brown bandicoots live in. We're talking open grassland, more like paddocks, rocky edges of paddocks, edges of cropping, that kind of thing. So Dunart Dens are the latest in the trifecta of miraculous, cheap-to-build biodiversity support solutions. And I was looking into lifting. That's a film that's on Twitter. If you look up hashtag Dunart Den or Dunart Dens, you'll find it. Showing that after a year in the field in a site that had an ecological burn, a native grassland, it's been used by the very thing that I was hoping would use it. And verification that that may be a tool, another tool, because Dunarts live in multiple landscapes across Australia. Another tool to help landholders, farmers, whoever, put something out that they know will help those little critters avoid predators is super rewarding. So look forward to when the trifecta of amazingness ends up going on to a location. I'm still working out what I'm going to do with this IP so that anybody can access these resources and build them for themselves.
That's so great, Lisette. I think as somebody who's I would struggle to make something, like put my whole heart and soul into it and then give it out to people for free. So I have to applaud you for that, Lisette. That is amazing.
It's the right thing to do. It's a good thing to do. And these are not my only inventions, but these are ones that I truly believe that helping more people on the land do more to help and protect and survey for biodiversity that they've got is the right thing to do. And I feel that very strongly, which might sound like I'm some kind of altruistic freak. But really, I've come to understand as I've got older that you've got one crack at this life. And if you're going to go for it, go hard. And some people are interested in money and some people are interested in fame. I'm not interested in really in either of those things. I'm interested in helping other people get ahead.
And that really shines through. Like everything you do that I've seen, all your content, I follow you on LinkedIn and on Twitter, and everything is so value-based. You think very hard about what you're putting out there. You're not just putting out there little snippets or little things that aren't really going to help people. Basically, every single post you put out there has incredible value in it that can really help people.
Thanks.
Oh, you're most welcome.
That's probably the nicest thing anybody said to me for ages.
Well, people should be telling you that every day, Lisette.
Yeah, that would be nice. I'd start to probably get an ego the size of Erebus, and that wouldn't be a good thing. I think it's sometimes an expectation on people who work for a natural resource management organisations to be quite altruistic. It occurs to me that, I've probably done myself out of some quite large income streams here, but there's always people out there who are looking for people like me who can teach others how to do stuff, who can front up to a group of landholders and say, this thing, here's how easy it is to make, and you can make that, and this is what it does. And I'm quite confident that there will be people listening to this podcast saying to themselves, we need to get that lady out here to come and talk to us about that. And we're willing to pay for that.
Yes, I think you would be most open to opportunities like that.
I would, yeah, because I love doing it.
Thank you so much for a great episode, Lisette. I really appreciated our chat. It was awesome.
Thank you. Kapai, well done.
Natural resource management doesn't happen because the government sets a budget. It doesn't happen because we all agree it's important. And it doesn't happen because you retweeted a post about COP27. It only happens because people like Lisette put their minds and hearts into it. They turn up every day and do the work, and they do it with pizzazz, in whatever capacity they're working in. NRM is a great field to genuinely make a difference in your local ecosystem. If you'd like to get into this field, please feel free to post your resume on hortpeople.com for free and tick the NRM job category box. If you're on Twitter or LinkedIn, Lisette is one of the most consistently great follows that you'll find because she's actually doing the work and she has a knack for communicating her experiences and her ideas. Check the show notes.